It's not every day you get to speak with an Olympic bronze medalist, a silver medalist, and a gold medalist. I found it super interesting to learn about the transition Caitlin Osmond had from athletic career to what she's up to today, the ups and downs that came with that, and to learn about the expectations she had for herself every time she stepped on that ice to compete. I bet it's not what you expected, because it certainly wasn't what I thought. Enjoy the episode with Caitlin Osmond.
Hey, I'm Jordan Harding. I grew up watching my dad put on that suit and tie every morning and go out to successfully climb the corporate ladder. I thought I wanted to be him, but I was wrong. I needed to be me. To do that, I had conversations with incredible people to learn how they figured out this whole thing called life. I learned how they overcome adversity and pick themselves up when they've been knocked down. Now, I'm sharing those discussions with you so you can apply those same learnings to your life. Welcome to It's Not a Straight Line.
So I'm super excited to have Caitlin Osmond on the podcast. Caitlin, I'm really curious to speak with you because you've lived for many a dream athletic career. You're originally from Marystown, Newfoundland. I know you moved around. We can touch on that. But you won a bronze in ladies figure skating in 2018, which is just incredible. You were gold in the team event in figure skating in 2018 and silver in 2014 in the team event. And you also, I believe, were the first women's world champion in 45 years. Is that correct?
That is correct.
That's amazing. Caitlin, I know post-athletic career too, you ended up moving to Toronto, you moved to Brantford for a bit, I read, and you're doing broadcasting right now, as well as you're in a media and journalism program at the University of Alberta. Let's go back to your athletic career and kind of just dive right in. What's it like for anyone listening to put on, you know, that outfit you're going out to skate and know you're skating on behalf of the country you love? Do you remember the first time you did that at the 2014 games?
I was so oblivious to everything. I'm very naive to like the sport and the sport world in general. So for me, when I went to the Olympics, I was only 18 my first year there. And I was really new to like the international scene and figure skating in general. And I never thought I had the ability to make it to an Olympic game. So I never even like thought about it until I was there. And I didn't actually qualify into the Olympics until like 2-3 weeks before. So it was like really fresh. And I showed up and everyone was like kind of like really bubbling and excited and like trying to figure, some people were crying. And I was just looking around. I was like, what is the big deal? I don't get it. And instead I walked into the rink and my coach is always like very subtly just trying to get my reaction towards things just to see like where I'm going, which I've recently started talking to him about that. And it's really funny how he just like subtly put it in there. So he walked into the rink and he would look at me and be like, so what are you thinking? And I was like, wow, the rink is really blue. So it's always like stuff like that really makes my skating journey interesting because I didn't really think about it as like this big over the top amazing thing. But yeah.
When did you start knowing like, hey, I could be one of the best skaters in the world?
Never.
Never.
No, I love that. It really didn't cross my mind. Which I realized is after talking to my coach Ravi, we started going through all of these things, as I said. And he said he never wanted me to feel like I had that I could be at the top level because he didn't want me to give up or say like, oh, I'm already good enough as it is. I don't need to work on it. And I didn't realize how much that actually like sunk in deep into me because I was like, oh, Ravi's never told me that I could be amazing. So I'm not going to be amazing. I think that's how my brain transferred it, but it also like made my career a lot more relaxing because I didn't have those like expectations from other people. So like there's pros and cons to everything. But I never really thought about it. Even in my last 2 years when I was podiuming at more multiple competitions, I kind of just thought that I was kind of getting lucky or that it was cool, but I never really thought like I was a good skater. I don't know.
Did that mindset really help you? Like, it sounds like you almost didn't put a huge amount of expectations on yourself.
I never put expectations on myself, which I think was an amazing blessing that I had. My expectations usually going into competitions was, especially when I was younger, was let's not come last today, which was great because usually I ended up winning. So it was cool. As I got older, so I guess like the only competitions that I really had expectations for myself was our national championships. And for some reason, that was the only competition in the year that I was like, this is the one I'm going to win. This is what I'm going to put my effort into. I'm like, I don't know why I didn't put that mentality into other competitions in my life. Because it always seemed to work really well at nationals. And then, well, sometimes anyways, it had some good years, some not good years. But yeah, and then going to my last couple competitions, which was the Olympic Games and World Championships, it was hard to put expectations on myself on like, okay, this is a good competition. I was like, I doubt I'm going to win. Like it's too tough of a competition. But I was like, maybe I could aim for third. So that was my only time I like aimed for a podium kind of, and it worked. I was on the podium and I was like, okay, cool. And then at the World Championships, I was exhausted. I didn't even think I could make it through my program. So my expectations for that was like, let's get from point A to point B and see what happens. And that ended up with me winning. So I don't know.
That's amazing. And, you know, I rewatched the 2018, I think it's a long program. And when you finished that, you were in second, correct? Do you remember?
Yeah, I would have been. So I was sandwiched between the two Russians, which I thought was really funny.
And then at that point, did it sink in? Like, I'm probably going to be on the podium, or were there a bunch of skaters still to go and you just had those chill expectations again?
At the Olympics, I knew right away that I was going to be on the podium. But it wasn't really like the shock value of being on the podium that did it, because there was only one person after me. The girl who ended up winning the Olympics was the one who was ahead of me already. And I knew, I was like, okay, like I'm going to come third. There's no doubt that I'm going to come third. But that wasn't the shock value for me. For me, it was my actual like skate and my personal performance. Because for me, like results, I think this was like part of that expectation side of it where I didn't have a lot of expectation, is that results were just results. They didn't mean anything to me that much. To me, I was very self-centered and I wanted to do my best. I still say I'm very self-centered in that way. So I would go into competitions and be like, okay, this is my plan. This is my goal. I want to do this for myself. Whatever happens, happens. And I had two of my best skates that I've ever had in my career in that point. I had the best short program of my life, and I had the best first clean long program in 7 years for me. So like for me, that was my reward. I got to finish in front of like all my friends who were in the audience, because well, being a women's skater, we're the last event of every Olympics. It's very right. Annoying. So yeah, I got to see everyone up in the stands, and then I heard my score and it was like 10 points higher than my personal best. And it was the first time I think I ever squealed at hearing a score. And I looked over and my coach was shocked. And like, my coach is never shocked. He has a very, very good like poker face. So yeah, I've come to learn like the talk behind the scenes were a little bit more like, oh my God, she could actually do this. But my coach was really good at sheltering me from that and just making sure that I stuck to my goal. He already knew how nervous I was in that moment in time. So he's like, I'm not going to add to her nerves of saying like, hey, if you do this today, you're going to end up third. So yeah.
I've heard you speak once about the emotion and the power after finishing that long program. It was almost like looking at your family and friends and fellow like competitors and teammates. That was so powerful to you.
It was one of my hardest struggles that I dealt with in like my career and being a teenager in general, and then also into my adulthood now, it's just that feeling like I don't actually belong anywhere. I didn't believe I belonged on a competitive international ice. I didn't believe that my friends like really wanted to be my friends. I don't know. I was just weird that way. And when I got to finish that program and it went really well, I like the relief that I felt and like the ability that I could just say like, guys, this is what I can do. I'm like, I told you I can do this, but I'm like, no one's really seen it. And so then I was able to do that. And then I saw my friends in the stand and I saw their reactions. I'm like, okay, maybe like they do care about me. So yeah, I don't know. That's kind of where I was in there.
Who would you always look for in the stands? Like, as someone who's not been an athlete, who's played just rec sport, like, who do you look up for? Are you looking up for your parents? Are you
look for anyone? I told you I'm very self-centered. I didn't look for anyone in the stands. One, because I can't see anyone anyways. In my opinion, there's too many people. There's too many like moving bodies. I don't necessarily know where everyone's sitting. So I'm like, if I'm going to look for someone specific, I'm going to be looking around and looking like an idiot. For me, I like taking in like everybody as a whole. So after I skated, especially at the Olympics there, I got a standing ovation. There's a lot of cheering. There was a lot of like Canadian flags being raised up. And for me, like just feeling that energy from everyone was like, this is what's special. So I kind of just looked around and like took everything in, but I can't guarantee I actually saw anything.
Well, and sometimes the way you're saying self-centered, it almost feels like you're not sure if that's like the right way to be. But what I think's really cool about that is you're almost focused on just competing against yourself.
Yeah.
Is that how it was for you?
It was. Every single competition. I don't know where that came from. I don't know if it's like just the way I was raised with my parents. I don't know. And then I've kind of talked about it with my coach, and he talked about when I first went senior within Canada, like there wasn't many women skaters in Canada at that point. And he kept trying to tell me, he's like, you're not competing to be the best in Canada, but you're competing till you want to compete with the best in the world. So I always looked beyond Canada to like look but I never really watched skating. So it's like, I don't know how to explain it. It was like, I wanted to be better than just being the best in Canada, but I didn't really believe I was good enough to be the best in the world. So I was like caught in that like in between stages of not really knowing where I belonged. And in doing so, I wanted to say like, I have a goal. I know what I want to accomplish here. And I was like, if I do it, I do it. If I don't, I'm going to be mad at myself. But like, I can't control what the other skaters are doing. I can't control if the ice is slipperier that day than other days. Everyone knows that the judging is sometimes very unpredictable.
Yes, yes.
And I was tired of being disappointed on the scores I would get, or disappointed or confused by things. So I didn't care about the scores. I didn't care about the competitors. I didn't care about the results. I cared about if I put on the performance that I wanted.
Wow. You know, I was just at a conference on Monday, Caitlin, and Michael Pinball Clemens was there. He used to play for the Argonauts, and he's the coach. He's the president of Argos. And he's like, hey, I'm going to give everyone a doctorate, like a PhD in 3 minutes. And P was for positivity. It wasn't about toxic positivity. It was about the impact you have on people and you know, moving them in your day, not being neutral. Like, you could just show up and do all your work, but if you're just doing that, you're not making a difference. And H was being humble enough to realize you have to give it your best. And then D was discipline. But when you're speaking, it was like, you were humble enough to know you wanted to give it your very best. And I think that's what, to me, is coming through as powerful.
Yeah, that was my goal. Looking back, of course, if I wanted to change anything about my career, I would wish that I knew that I had the ability to do it, but then also keep the innocence to it. So I don't know, yes, if there's a happy balance there. because... like I said, when I went to nationals, that was when I was like, okay, I'm going to put all in to win this competition. And often it worked. Sometimes it didn't. and I just wish I kind of had that same mentality, because in those last 2 years of my competitive career, when I did start winning, of course, there's a subconscious part of me that was like, I want to do well at this competition. I want to make it to the Grand Prix final. I want to see what's going to happen here. But, and in those moments, it worked. Like, I was skating really well, but there was still like that innocence to it that I was kind of shocked every time it went well. So yeah, I don't know. I was a very weird character.
And, you know, I want to touch on your coach. You mentioned him a few times. His name was Ravi.
Ravi Wall. Yeah.
And it seems like he was your coach for a long time.
Since I was 10 years old.
Wow. And was it throughout your entire career?
Practically. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I started in Newfoundland. I was with a coach, Jessica Goss, there. Went to Montreal with Josie Picard. And then from there, I moved to Alberta and started training with Ravi when I was 10. So that would have been like really early into my competitive career. So yeah, he stuck with me all the way until 22. And I was like, okay, I'm out, I'm done. And now I coach some of his skaters. So he still tells me what to do.
That's so cool. And, you know, I think it's so important in life, whether you're an athlete or anything you're doing, to have those people around you, right? Whether it's your parents, your siblings, your coaches, your therapist,
yeah,
you know, they're all helpful. And it seems like you had a very special relationship with your coach.
I did. And actually, that's a big reason why I moved back to Edmonton from Distillery, is that when I first retired, I kind of abandoned all of those people. Everyone, I moved to Toronto. I left my parents here. I left my sister here. I left my coach here. I didn't even tell him in person that I was going to be done. I sent him an email because I was just fed up with a lot of things. So yeah, I left my psychologist. I left my trainers. Like, I left everything behind. I was like, I needed to escape.
Yeah.
And then during COVID, living in Toronto, I was doing a lot better, not great, yeah, but I was doing better. And then I came back during Christmas one year when it was a little bit safer to do so. If it wasn't, then I apologize to people who got mad at me for flying. But I came back to Edmonton and I saw some of my friends that I was that I grew up with here. I actually went outdoor skating and ran into Ravi coaching his skaters on outdoor rink because all the rinks
were closed. No way. And you had no idea.
No idea. Just ran into them there. And so it was like random things like that. And I was like, I know why I left, but I was like, I need their help again. So I moved back. I started working with my own psychologist that I had back when I competed. Ravi took me in and started letting me coach some of his skaters. And then has found me skaters of my own. So yeah.
Yeah, and I think it's so cool how you're open about your psychologist and your therapy. You've been open about it on social media, and that was one of the things I was pretty curious about when, you know, like I told you before we started, I saw you skate in 2014, and CBC had this like montage of you being from Marystown, Newfoundland, and your personality, and then, you know, following, and then all of a sudden, you know, realizing you were in Distillery, and then you were posting and blogging, and you were pretty open about what you were going through. And I know a lot of athletes and just people in general are that way. Mm-hmm. And it's so interesting, right? Like, you know, I've said on this podcast many times how I've gone through depression, anxiety, and have had therapists and people around me. And, you know, I wasn't open to admitting that until maybe like 2 years ago, right? And the best athletes in the world have these people around them. So like, why shouldn't other people get that?
No, I 100% agree. I first started with a psychologist when I was about 18 years old, following when I broke my ankle. Because I was dealing with a lot of frustration around injuries already, to the point that it was, even before I broke my leg, my injuries were getting to the point that I was like, I didn't want to do this anymore.
Kaylin, was this after the 2014 games? Yeah.
This was after the 2014 games, and I was so frustrated with injuries, and I was like, if I get injured one more time, I'm done. And then I ended up breaking my leg. So I was like, wow, that's really careful what you say in the world.
Careful what you put out into the universe.
Yeah. And then when I got back from, when I was still recovering from that, I was set up with a psychologist to get me into school, back into skating, and try to help with those fears around injuries. And she convinced me to quit skating. She was going to write a letter to Ravi because she knew that I was scared of telling him, and a bunch of stuff. And then I was just like, I don't think this psychologist is for me.
That's right.
So I ditched psychology completely and tried to just manage it the way that I always had, with like just talking to my coaches and everything like that. And I did that for about 2 more years and realized it wasn't working at all. So following one of my competitive years, my first year back to competing after I broke my ankle, I was miserable after each competition, and I was like, why am I doing this? So I was like, I could either be done right now, after 2 of the worst years in my skating career, after 18 years on the ice or something like that, or 16 years on the ice, or I could get help and push through for 2 more years until the next Olympics. So that's what we did. We looked for a new psychologist. I got started with her in the September following. I worked with her every single week, every Tuesday after skating. And it just became a safe space for me to, one, just figure out why I was scared of random things or what was making my confidence drop quite a bit, had a fake confidence so that I would trick myself into thinking I was stronger than I was. And sometimes it was just solely to rant about whatever, and just being able to rant about, I was 19 at this point. So I was like 19 or 20. So I'm like being able to rant about boys or my parents or my coaches or anything along those lines. It just like, it frees up so much extra space in your brain. So,
Take me back though to that time with your injury, mm-hmm. and you were like, I might give it up. You know, that I heard you say your coach would send you on like seminars and out to speaking. Like, what did that do to kind of get you kickstarted from a mindset standpoint?
I hate training.
I love the honesty.
I find it extremely boring, and we would have to kind of change up like ways that we would train to keep me entertained on the ice. It's really bad, actually, how much I hated training. But I also understood at this point in my career that like to train, I had to train to be able to compete the way I wanted. But when I was injured, I was training full time, but I didn't have the competitions to break it up. So it was just like very monotonous, very repetitive. And I was just sick of all of it. And frustrated because my ankle would like give, like I ended up having to go back for surgery after a few months to get the metal taken out of my leg because it was just very uncomfortable and continuously swelling in my skate. So I had a hard time with that. So when it came time for the spring, which is usually when a lot of clubs will have like their people in for seminars, they'll have them in for like their club carnivals at the end of the year. That's when Ravi was like, you know what, let's just get you out of Edmonton. Let's send you to some of these seminars, go to some of these shows. I wasn't going full out in these shows. I wasn't doing triples or anything. So they were pretty much like pretty safe. They were a good intro into performing again. And it was just a way to break up the training. And that's what I loved about skating, was performing and teaching and all of those amazing things. So it was a great way to like put myself back out there again, and also just break up the monotonous of the annoying training that I loved just so much.
Would you admit that to your coach, or did your parents know that as you went through, or did you only start saying that after you had retired?
I think they clued in pretty quickly. Probably not with the fact that I hated training, but they knew that I got bored training really easily. Unless I had a very specific plan. If I had a very specific plan, I could follow that to a T. I think probably just because my brain didn't have to think at all. And as long as my brain doesn't have to think, like the time flies by. But they knew it pretty young, when, especially when I was like 11 or 12 years old. I apparently came to the rink one day and looked at Ravi, and I was like, there's only 26 days left until my next competition. And he just looked at me, he's like, what? And I was like, why? I haven't written on a calendar on my wall. Like, I keep track of it. So I think in that point, he clued into how much I love competing. And that didn't really change throughout my entire career. I always had a calendar that counted down the days until my next competition. So,
So Kaylin, you end up retiring, I think it was 2019, right? And how old were you when you retired, if you don't mind?
Well, my last competition was in 2018, so I was 22. So I would have been 23 when my official retirement got announced. Yeah.
And did you know when you were doing that last competition or skate? No, you didn't know that was going to be the last one.
No, I didn't know. Part of me was really exhausted. I'm still trying to figure out that time in my life. I'm still trying to break it down in front of around a lot of people. I was really, really exhausted that year. There was a lot put in between the 4 years of Olympics, between breaking my ankle, joining psychology, putting in a lot of work and hours. And that last Olympic year, I was dealing with a back injury that just was very draining in general. So by the time, and competing at a world championship following an Olympics is like emotional roller coaster overload. And just so exhausting. So by the time I finished competing, I was drained completely. And I wanted to go home, but instead I went on tours right away, which was really, really cool. So I went to Japan and then I came back and I had a couple weeks where I went and chopped off all my hair and went to Newfoundland, did a few like homecoming things there. And then I went into Canadian Stars and then I went to Korea for like a week for more shows. And then I finally came back and relaxed. So that was, I pretty much went from March until the beginning of June without really getting a break after all of that. And I think just with how exhausted I already was with that, I started getting even more exhausted, even though I was doing the parts of skating that I love. And I definitely needed a break when I got back.
Yeah.
But I don't think I took long enough of a break. I took about 3 weeks off, which is the most I've ever taken off. And even then, when I came back, I wasn't ready. And Ravi was like, okay, well, how about we just choreograph a show program for next year? Because he knew that when I got to learn new choreography, that was usually when I was most excited. So we did choreograph a program for the next year. But at this point, I already knew about the Scott and Tessa Thank You Canada tour. And I was like, I want to be a part of that next year instead. So we agreed to take the first half of the season off then. And then by the end of summer, like I still wasn't back to where, like, I still couldn't train full time. Like I just didn't have the motivation anymore. I didn't have the energy. So at the end of summer, we were like, okay, let's just take the whole year off. And I was
well,
I'm going to take the whole year off. Then I was like, I want to try different things. So I went on tour with Thank You Canada, for 2.5 months, which was an incredible, incredible experience for me. And then I came back and I did some other shows like in New York and stuff like that, which was really nice. And then I went and volunteered at Nationals in the media center. So I had a great time there being on the volunteer. But then Ted Barton, who I actually work with now with the broadcasting for Skate Canada, he invited me to go up onto the commentary panel to commentate the junior women event. And as I was about to go up there, I got told that I wasn't allowed to because I wasn't officially retired. So like it was a conflict of interest or something. I don't know how it was a conflict of interest, especially because it wasn't even the senior events. So I was like, okay, cool. I'm like, I just won't. And then I got invited to go to Japan for Worlds to announce that Worlds were going to be in Canada the following year, which I was like, wow, that's amazing. Like, I want to get into like talking a lot more. So I'm like, I would absolutely love to go to Japan. I always will never turn down a chance to go to Japan. And I was actually in Switzerland right before that. And they went to me, I got an email saying, turns out we don't need you to go to Worlds because again, where I wasn't retired, there was a conflict of interest. I don't understand any of this. I didn't understand the mentality around it. And I just got really annoyed with being like, okay, I want to try these new things. And I keep getting shut down about them.
Yeah. And you weren't even competing in those specifically.
No. And I wasn't competing. I was still pretty tired. I started having like panic attacks when I was in shows. So I started losing a lot of confidence during those times too. And my job started getting a lot more difficult. And in all of that time, like the entire year afterwards, before I even announced my retirement, not once did someone reach out to me and ask me if I was going to come back. My coach didn't really reach out to me that much. I didn't hear from anyone at Skate Canada for an entire year about coming back. And I just felt like, wow. I was like, okay, cool. So if I step away, which I did, I'm like, nobody really cares. And if I'm already someone who struggles a lot with like feeling like I belong somewhere and then feeling like just nobody gave a damn that I was out of there, I just got really frustrated and really down. So I emailed everyone and said, I'm done. I'm not coming back. My parents wanted to have this big celebration for my retirement. I told them no, I didn't want it. So when I announced my retirement, right, in May of 2019, I was actually on tour with Stars on Ice. We arranged it that I would go into CBC Studios at 7 o'clock in the morning, do 4 or 5 announcements as to why I was retiring, and that was it. And then my parents finally got their way and they got a retirement party for me the next year in December. But yeah.
Where did they hold it? Did they hold it in Newfoundland?
They held it in Edmonton, actually, at our condo building. So, because I didn't want anything big or spectacular. I think just because I was so done.
Well, and I also read that they move when you were 10, you moved out while you were already going to Montreal, I think, for training. I read somewhere that Marystown didn't have ice as much in the summer, but you can correct me. But you went to Edmonton, I think, or Alberta because they worked in the oil industry, or they had to. Is that true?
Yeah. So I grew up in Newfoundland until I was about 8-9 years old. But we didn't have a lot of ice opportunities from the time, like from March until October-ish. If it wasn't hockey season, it was not figure skating season. So we had troubles getting ice in general from those times. So we started traveling to Montreal during the summers to get extra training. And then eventually we just made the move. But my parents didn't speak French. And in 2006, you kind of needed to speak French in Montreal. But that was even before 2006. I moved to Edmonton in 2006. That was in 2004, 2005. And also they worked in the oil industry. So that also didn't really bode well for Montreal. So we moved with our coach for a little bit. And then we ended up moving my aunt up to Montreal, and she from Newfoundland. And she lived with us, me and my sister, to help us get from place to place. And then when I was 10, my sister originally quit skating for the first time. She quit a few times before she actually did. And when she quit, my sister was always supposed to be like the better skater. I was just the tag along. So when she quit, my family was like, well, why are we all living in different provinces? Like, my brother was in Newfoundland. Me and my sister were in Montreal, and my parents were in Fort McMurray. So they're like, why are we spread out so much? So we moved to, my parents reached out to the club in Fort McMurray, and the coach there said, I don't coach at the level that they can skate. So he suggested that we move to Edmonton. So when we moved to Edmonton, they reached out to a couple of different clubs, Gravy being one of them, and just kind of stuck with that. Then they still like traveled back and forth between Edmonton and Fort McMurray. So my aunt still kind of lived with us for quite a while until my sister could drive. And then she kind of started moving out. But yeah.
That's cool. And yeah, I did hear you talk about your sister in one interview you did, and it sounded like, you know, you got started so early because she was on the rink.
Yeah.
You have said a few times she was the better younger skater than you, and you could kind of just fly under the radar.
It was great. I got away with, and I think that's part of where my innocence came from and where like my naivety towards skating came from, is that she protected me from a lot of it. I started skating when I was 2. Because I was at the rink every day, because she started when she was 3. She's 3 years older than me. So I was at the rink anyways. And because of it, when she got to go to seminars and stuff, I usually tagged along, even though I was technically too young to go to some of those camps. I kind of got to tag along and either just watch, or they were like, well, since she's here, she can just get on the ice anyways. So I kind of got pushed into things, that even if I didn't fully belong there. And then, yeah, I kind of just got to see a lot of cool things because of her. And then if some of like the dramas towards skating, like she got weighed, well, we both got weighed every week when we were living in Montreal. But she was a bit older, and where she was supposed to be the better skater, she was getting like, I don't know, picked apart more because of her weight.
Even at what age do they start like picking apart your weight? And does that still happen today?
I don't know if it still happens. I don't do that with my skaters, so I don't know. But I would have been 9 when I started getting weight every week, but I didn't really get picked apart for it. So I kind of got, like I said, I flew under the radar. And then when we moved here, when I was 10, I don't think I got weight again until I was 15, 16 years old. So it just depends on what club you're, what coach you have and what their ideas towards all of that are.
Yeah, for sure. Well, Caitlin, you know, congratulations on all this success you had as a skater. You truly made Canada proud. Every time I watch the Olympics, you give the country so much pride, and you did that. So really embody that. That's powerful. When you know, retired and then you moved, I think, to Brantford, and then you talked about Distillery District in Toronto. You know, that then the pandemic, I think, was going on. So a real fun place. You're in Toronto and the pandemic's going on, if I have the timeline right. What was that like for you? Like, you probably did not want to be in Toronto when that was going on, but here you are, or here you were at the time.
Actually, I think Toronto was the perfect place for me to be during the pandemic, which is kind of crazy to say.
Nice.
But yeah, when I like retired from skating, I mentioned that first year after retirement, I was pretty much traveling full time between tours and Switzerland. But I was dating someone in Brantford who was a figure skater. So on my days off, I usually ended up in Brantford. And when I initially announced my retirement, I was like, well, it was actually before I announced my retirement that I moved to Brantford again. But I didn't want to be around people anymore. I didn't want to be around anything that I was connected to anymore. And I was like, I was in a long distance relationship for the last like year of my competing. So I was like, okay, you know what? I'm like, I'm just going to make the move. So I made the move there, and it was great, except I realized I didn't have anything of my own there. And I ended up living with two competing athletes who were very much into their career, and my mentality was changing a lot, and I didn't want to think about skating very much. My body started changing, and then I started having issues with that. And living with two competing boys, they don't really understand that. So I ended up going back on the Rock the Rink tour. And during that tour, I met people that were outside of the skating world. I applied to school in Toronto, and I was like, okay, I need to go back and actually make something for myself. Which actually ended up being the end of my relationship, which really sucked, which was really hard. So I moved out of Brantford and kind of couch hopped between friends' places in Toronto for a month. And at that time, the Christmas market was in Distillery. So I went to the Christmas market one day with a friend, and I looked up at the building and I was like, I want to live there. I was like, right now, this is where I need to be. And when I was in Edmonton for Christmas that year, I was like looking for apartments to move into in Toronto. And it just so happened that there was one unit in my price range available in Distillery. And I was like, all right. So I ended up moving in January 1st and was getting my life kind of back to normal. I was still dealing with a lot of like the heartbreak from the breakup and the confusion of living in Toronto by myself, but I was walking everywhere. I was trying new things. I got connected with Kurt Browning and Jesse, who was a dancer, who actually ended up being from Edmonton, but I met her in Toronto, and she ended up choreographing, her and Kurt ended up choreographing this piece of program for me that was just super fun and crazy for Stars and Ice that year. And I was like kind of just getting my life figured out from what I thought I was getting figured out. And then COVID happened. So then everything started changing, because I was like, I don't have shows. I don't have a relationship. I don't get to see any of my friends. I ended up escaping to Edmonton for the first month of it. And then I realized, I was like, okay, no, I have my apartment in Toronto. I'm paying for it. And I can't live in an apartment with my parents right now. So I was scared to fly. So my dad drove me back to Toronto.
Oh, wow.
He's like, it's a nice little week vacation for him.
Yeah,
he drove me back. Well, he drove himself back, slept in the car. It was easy peasy. And I stayed in Toronto, and during the summer I ended up starting hanging out with Nam Nguyen and my friend Aaron, and the three of us were pretty much inseparable. We ended up all living in different, alone in different apartments. So we just kind of bounced between each other's apartments. and like, we'd just go to parks, and it just was the first time in my life that I wasn't working or training or anything. And people were telling me that was okay. And because the world was shut down, it's not like I was just not doing it. It was because I couldn't do it. And it actually was very, very freeing. and it felt really good. And then when the world started reopening again, that's when I realized, I was like, okay, I need to start doing stuff. And then I started panicking again a lot more. So then I ended up moving back here, which my dad always told me was a flight risk, because the minute that I get uncomfortable somewhere, I move. So here in Edmonton, I'm buying a house so that, so that I had an investment in my life. But also because I bought it, I can't leave as easily.
There you go.
When I get those like jitters of, I need to get out of here, I can't. So it's kind of keeping me here.
So now you're at University of Alberta. You're doing, is it journalism or communications?
It's called media studies.
Media studies?
Media studies. I'm attempting to change my minor to creative writing. Okay. I don't really need a minor, so we'll see if that one actually happens. But so I'm majoring in media studies. I did a year and a half of journalism in Toronto. But when I moved back to Edmonton, everything was still online. And they're like, yeah, it's fine. You can just finish it online. I only had a year and a half left. And then when school started, they told me I had to move back to Toronto. And I was like, well, I'm not moving back to Toronto. And then none of my credits transferred. So I had to restart.
Oh my gosh. Were you like, okay, whatever, I'll just restart? Or was that like, oh my God, this is such a pain in the ass?
I ended up taking another year off school.
Yeah.
Because it was already too late for me to apply to start school in Edmonton, because I didn't find out until already school had started in Toronto. So it was like the week before school had started that I emailed them and said like, hey, is this okay? I'm like, I'm not seeing any links for the online classes anymore. And they're like, oh yeah, we're giving everyone 30 days to move back to Toronto. And I was like, cool, thank you. So I ended up just dropping it, which, because I dropped it so late, I only got like half my tuition back, which I was like, great. I was really mad about that.
I
started coaching here. I started working at the Edmonton Zoo. So it was very random. And then I started getting back into training. I ended up going back on Stars on Ice for a year. For the spring tour. And then while I was on tour, I applied to U of A and I got accepted. So I was like, all right, we'll just go there.
Was there any skater? Stars on Ice, for those that don't know, it's amazing. You should go see it. I'm pretty sure it's still going on, but you got to skate with some amazing people on that throughout your career. You got to know some incredible athletes. Was there anyone growing up you kind of looked up to?
That whole obliviousness to skating meant no, I did not watch skating.
I thought you might say.
I looked up to my sister.
There you go. That's amazing.
So I wanted to see if I could do it too. And then I beat her and then she quit. But no. So when I started competing internationally, one of the skaters that competed before me at Skate Canada International in 2012, I think that was Akiko Suzuki. And I watched her practice that day and I was like, I want to be like her. She's amazing. And I started looking up to her, and I think I only competed against her for a year. I don't even think she went to the Olympics the next year. So I think I only competed against her for a year. But I really looked up to her after seeing her skate in person the first time. And then I actually beat her at that competition. So I think that was a little weird. I was first and she was second. So... I was like, wow, I'm looking up to you, but I just beat you. But I thought it was like such a fluke that I was like, I could never beat this person ever again. And I don't know if I actually competed against her again. I must have. I don't know. So I looked up to her, but not until I saw her in person.
Wow. That's the interesting answer. Kaylin, what about when you're, what year of this program are you in?
Two.
Two. So when you're there and you're just like hanging out on campus, I've heard you say before you're kind of a shyer person, although you wouldn't know it from you're great to speak to. It just flows. Do people know, like, hey, you have an Olympic gold, bronze, and silver, and you're world champion? Or do you kind of just like to, you probably don't want to start with, hey, this is what I used to do.
I don't usually start with that, no.
No.
A little bit more this semester in a couple of my classes. That sounds really bad the way I said that. But no, I am very shy normally. If you get me in any other situation. If it's me talking about skating like this, or at a rink coaching or broadcasting, like, I'm magically not shy. But if I'm caught in a situation where I actually had to like text someone, I'm terrible at texting and emailing, as you've come to learn. But I am very, very shy in that retrospect. Even the friends that I met on skating, like, I'll rarely talk to them because I feel like if I text them, I'm intruding on their space. I don't know why. My brain is weird. And the same thing at school. I show up, this is my second year at school, and there is a handful of people that I've talked to, and I've never talked to them outside of class. So I rarely get the chance to talk about anything skating related. There's only a few of my profs that have learned, because one actually knew who I was and kept calling it out during class, to the point that it was very condescending the way she would say it, to the point I actually had to email her and say, like, can you stop bringing this up, because it's kind of mean the way you're bringing it up.
That's weird. That's awkward that very, that happened. Very weird.
But I ran into a lot of issues like in high school and stuff like that, where my school would try to celebrate, because I went to a sports school. So if I won nationals, which I did, or won an international, they would put it on a little TV screen at the front, and like the news that would cycle through it. And it would have my name on it or something like that. And people kind of made fun of me for that. They're like, oh, you must be like too good or something like that. And like, oh, because you did this, you're like, you don't want to talk to us anymore. And I don't know. But I kind of lost a lot of friends because of it, I felt like. So yeah, I don't really bring it up unless someone brings it up to me first, or if there's like a valid reason for me to bring it up.
Yeah, it's always tough. It's kind of, I imagine it's pretty tough when you're having that success at the world level. People start maybe thinking you'll be different, and maybe you don't even want to be, like, I don't even know.
I don't know, because I've had friends be like, well, other people in the sport be like, yeah, when I started winning all these things, all these people wanted to be my friend, and it was really cool, except I started not trusting them. And I was like, I don't know what you're talking about, because when I started winning things, people stopped wanting to be my friend. And I was like, I wouldn't talk about it or anything unless they asked, and then they would just like stop talking to me. So maybe,
yeah, I guess it can go both ways.
Could be very annoying.
I highly doubt that. I want to end it off with like three zigzag questions, because it's not a straight line. Maybe we'll throw in four here and just answer them in a quick phrase or a few words. What kind of drives you today when you get up every day? What's still that spark within you?
I wish I knew. I'm still learning that.
Learning it. I love it.
My dog's help.
And we can have part two in like 3 years. Where do you, so congrats, by the way, you're on broadcasting a fair bit. Like, I've seen you, I think it was just Skate Canada that happened, and you did amazing with that. So I hope to continue to see you on the broadcast. Where do you see the opportunities in media to continue to help people tell their authentic story?
Well, from my broadcasting point of view, I try to get people to tell me their story, because I get a chance to be their voice, and I don't want to speak for them. So I think it's for the athlete trusting the people who are willing to talk about you, to get your story out the way you want. Social media is a powerful tool, but it's also exhausting. So yeah. Want to be able to tell your story, but also saving yourself to like be able to manage that. And being able to talk through someone else in media kind of takes that pressure off of you, I guess. And yeah, and also just be comfortable with sharing it, but also like coming from a sport that it's judged. unfortunately, you sometimes got to be careful about what you say.
Yeah, I can only imagine. Did you have a lot of trust when you started getting interviewed more, or were you just like, you know what, I'm going to say what I can say and have certain guidelines and if someone takes it out of context, they take it out of context.
It's a big reason why I wanted to get into media myself is because some people did take it out of context and then it sounded really bad. just like talking about one of my programs and someone would say that I was illiterate about my sport because I didn't know the storyline behind my program, which I did. I just didn't understand her question. I thought I understood her question, but apparently I did not because I didn't know what a streetwalker was. I was 21. I probably should have known what a streetwalker was, but I didn't. and stuff like that. But I knew my story. I knew what I wanted to say. I knew how to say it properly, the way I like to portray myself, the way that I wanted to be portrayed. But I also know how many times I had to like squash my own voice when it came to like injuries and stuff like that. One, because I didn't want to give myself the excuse to not skate well. Part of that. But also it's just that it didn't become my only story, especially when it was due to another injury, because there was already so much talk about me being injured a lot. So I was like, I don't really need to add to this. But all that like pushing things back made me really frustrated. And when I retired, I was like, here is everything.
Yeah. I love that. And I think you just might have nailed number one of what drives you. You said you want to help people craft their story and tell it authentically in a genuine way.
And that's what I loved about working at the zoo, except I didn't have to tell stories about people. I got to tell stories about animals. They can't talk back.
What's a lesson you look back to through your athletic career where you still use it today, whether it's going to school or you think it will help other people? Is there one thing that you could, I'm sure there's lots, but is there one thing you can pick out?
There was a saying that I always lived by when I skated, and it was like, find the joy in what you do and the passion will burn out the pain, which I lived by very like passionately when I skated. But then I also realized I was like, okay, there's a point where the pain becomes too much and that you should probably listen to it.
Yeah.
So it's like, I still live by that saying, but also trust your instincts. If you feel like something's not right, acknowledge it.
Caitlin, if people want to follow what's next for you, your career, want to see you on the broadcast with these skating events in Skate Canada. And, you know, I encourage everyone to get out to these competitions, fill those seats, because these athletes are incredible. How can people follow along? Is there any way people can follow along your journey?
For sure. You can either follow my Instagram, which I'm trying to be a little bit better at posting on, which is KateKiss, KaetKiss, KISS. That's mostly what I'm on.
Yeah. No, sometimes that's good.
But that one's a little bit less about what I'm actually doing and more just me being stupid.
TikTok, you said? Yeah.
TikTok.
Yeah, love it.
And then, yeah, so I'm on the broadcast for Ski Canada, hopefully again next year. It's a yearly contract, so I guess we'll see. But yeah, if you follow along on my Instagram, you'll see me there. And if you're ever in Edmonton, I'm at West Edmonton Mall a lot. So
there you go, West Edmonton Mall. Caitlin, thanks so much for being on the podcast. It's been really fun chatting with you.
Thank you.
What did you take away from our chat today? I'd love to know. Let me know on Instagram at It's Not a Straight Line or connect with me on LinkedIn. If this episode was helpful, would you mind leaving me a review on whatever podcast app you use? I'd really appreciate it. You can always go back to previous episodes to hear more insightful conversations to help you build your own unique life. Thanks for listening to It's Not a Straight Line. Until next time.